Welcome to Talking Anthropology. This is our new show on the Signal Hackerspaces project. And this is the pilot for our new show. And today we want to look at the Mexican hacker scene. And for this purpose, I have my interview partner from Mexico, Felixe. Yeah. Hello, Felixe. Maybe you introduce yourself and give a few words about where you come from and what you're doing.
Okay. Thank you. As you said, my name is Felixe. I'm coming from a diverse background because I have a degree on electronics and then a graduate degree, a master in science, also in electronics. And at this moment, I'm teaching electronics in a university at the electronics lab in the Universidad de las Américas. And I always had this passion about audio, so that's the first reason when I went to university to make pedals for my electric guitar, electronic pedals to modify the sound. Then when I got my degree, I decided to work and travel, and after a while, when I got bored, I start to think in the master, and I decided to make more audio, like digital algorithms for processing my guitar. So I had all this background in audio, and also I had a long time friends that we had a company that made web pages and everything. And we, for several years, we were fantasizing with the idea of having an office and a space, etc. And we saw that the idea of a hacker space suited us perfectly because we have all these diverse influences, like, for example, a desire for a photographic studio, a desire for a recording studio, a desire for a space as an office, a traditional office. So we started to look around to see if we could rent a house and move our things there, and I think we got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are located in Cholula, which is a town southeast of Mexico City. And how did you came to the idea of hackerspaces? Is this something well known in Mexico? Or how did you came to it?
Oh, this is not very well known. I think not known at all in Mexico. So I got the idea reading on the internet and reading about the history of several other hackerspaces in the world. And I was pretty interested in the different roads that a hackerspace can take. For example, you can have a hackerspace where you are more focused on the computing scene or in the open source scene or everything like that. But I saw the possibility to have one with the particular qualities that we were looking for. So I think it suited us perfectly. And that's when we started.
Mm-hmm. From which time do we speak? As far as I read in the wiki, you only started this July 2010, or? So how long did it take to really got to this open space you have now?
We started writing down the ideas and the goals, the objectives that we had in October 2009. So we decided and we had this imaginary date that at the start of the summer of 2010 we were going to start the project. So when we started to look for a house and we got the telephone number for this particular house that we are now in. We made the arrangements and everything. And when we saw that the date was June 1st of 2010, we We remembered that we had in a notebook somewhere the date June 1st of 2010. It will be the start of the hackerspace. So it was like a premonition, you know.
Remember this. That's your birthday. And yes. As far as I have found out in my research, you are the first and so far the only hackerspace in Mexico. So how was it to create the first one in your country? How was it to use this word hacker for something which is a public space available, at least public available on the internet?
Yeah, okay. There are two questions, and one of them is pretty important. The feeling of being the first hacker space was very thrilling for the three of us. We're really excited, and at the moment we're still very excited of trying to carry the name Hackerspace. But as you mentioned, what is the important part of being a public place or a public internet place with the name Hacker in it? It's part of an education, a part of a semiology that a lot of people, they don't have the full meaning. And you can see that you're in a position that you need to educate the person around you, or you can just leave them to get to know you by the things that you're working on. For example, if you are starting to offer workshops, free workshops, in garbage collection or residual separation, or if you start to, for example, tomorrow I will give a tutorial on basic digital audio and things like that. It's what when people are going to start to associate the name hacker with something that can make them a better citizens or a better environment if they want.
Okay. It has been 4 months so far till you opened up at the point where we're making this recording right now in September. Yeah. And what are the projects? What are the goals of your space? Do you want to be an innovation lab for the members? Do you want to be open and teach the public, or do you have a target set of what to reach?
We have several kind of goals to meet. For example, I think the most important goal to meet at this time is to reach a level of economic independence, because at this moment all the expenses, the rent of the place, and the all the fixed cost of living is going into us directly. So the first thing to do is to make this place as auto-sustained as possible. And then the second thing that we are at this moment trying to reach is that giving workshops to the people, to the diverse people that you can find in Cholula. That's a part of one part of the magic of this place, is that you have people from the university with a high level of education, and you have people from the town that they have a very low level of formal education, but they are trying to make things, and they are happy and willing to take a workshop and courses. That's where we are trying to balance the things that we do into the social scene, into the science, technology, hacker scene. That's our second goal, to find an equilibrium for these two sides of the people of the city that we are in.
Mm-hmm. How big is Cholula? How many inhabitants does it have?
It's a complex question, because there are three Cholulas. That will complicate things. But More or less, there are like from 20,000 people, 40,000. I guess that's an approximate estimate figure that can serve us as a reference. But the special thing is that Cholula has a lot of population that comes and goes because they are students from the university. It's a really big university. So you have like 8,000 students going on and off each semester. So it really impacts the culture of the town. That's part of the people that we are trying to focus, and also the people that have been living here for all their lives. Yeah, that's the answer.
That's classical, because often you have hacker spaces pop up close to universities or close to cities with quite a good status of wealth and culture of knowledge, of education. That's usually the surrounding it needs to create this liberal hacking culture. And how many people do you have in the space right now?
At this time, we are three friends. It's me, Felipe, and my friend Mondi. He's an illustrator, he's a graphic artist, and my friend Chucho, he's a photographer, also a graphic artist. And that's a representative of the combination of projects that we have in mind. And also, Mondi is a musician, and I'm a musician too. So we use the studio space for rehearsal with our respective bands. And I think the three people that we are at this moment in the project will slowly expand when we have a clear idea of the structure that we want to share with more members. For example, we have a lot of friends that are coming and going every day to use the space, for example, to make a stop motion test for a music video, or to come and go in the space to have sessions for yoga and Reiki and things like that. You see, there's a special mixture of elements and ideas and tendencies going along.
Mm-hmm. So your focus is on music and graphics and visual design. And one key I could give you, which is also sometimes lacking in the MetaLab here in Vienna, where I'm coming from, is documentation. To attract new people, it's always essential that you show to the public what you're doing. That you're not some crazy folks in the cellar. You are also a space where things happen, where things are possible, where someone can do, and what's this nice word? It's an autocracy, you know? You just come and do stuff, and if it's if someone has a problem, then it will evolve, and they will speak out. But first of all, just do it and just start your project, and then we can see how it works. What is your connection to the ideas of hacking? Why did you choose to be a hackerspace and not just a co-working space or something else?
Oh, okay, yeah. Part of the things that I do for a living is to sell Arduino kits. Arduino is a microcontroller platform to make technical things, artistic things, and everything. So I was really connected with the hacking scene, like students and artists and a lot of people trying to do things for performance, things for museums, things for the industry, things for a lot of things. And I guess that we decided to give it the chance for it to be a hackerspace when we decided that a lot of the things that we could reach in the future was to make artistic projects or make new media projects, interaction projects, based on my knowledge in electronics and microcontrollers and programming and everything. So basically that's where we decided that the focus was more on share our technical knowledge and to learn technical things from the people around us. That was the main decision for it to be a hacker space.
That's great. And maybe we talk about a bit about the situation in Mexico in general.
Okay.
You are the first hackerspace, so maybe there isn't much experience about this, but how was the reaction of the state authorities when you choose this name? Is it something they have any concept of, or are you completely far off and blanked out so far?
We are somewhere in the middle, but I think most to the side of the far off side of the things. But for example, when new people come to the space and they get to know it's a hacker space, they usually go crazy and start, oh, so you are hacking bank accounts and you're making all the cyber terrorism and everything, and you just laugh and you with a lot of patience try to explain, no, it's a different meaning of what the movies have made you believe what is a hacker. So I think that's part of the work. You have to show the new people that hacker doesn't necessarily mean that you're doing bad things with their information and things like that. So at this time, it's a little nuisance, but not very, very big one.
But it's good that you're doing this work to tell the public what a hacker is and what a cracker is.
Exactly.
And where do we stand? Because this really, it's, I know it's annoying, but it's necessary.
Exactly.
Let's speak a bit more about this do-it-yourself culture, because I think this is one of the important roots of the whole movement. Mm-hmm. And you said you work in university. Do you teach students?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are there any connections or benefits you can get out of this job? I mean, you are working with people who are willing to learn, and it is a different way of learning in university or in a hackerspace, I would think.
Yeah, I think the main benefit is to be surrounded all the time with fresh minds and fresh ideas and the strong desire of the people around me to make things, to learn about things, to open things up and try to see how they work and, well, what the hacker spirit is all about. So I think that's one of the main benefits. And also, as I am in full contact with the students, I know what their needs are. So, for example, I'm planning to make a workshop in October, possibly, focused on PCB making, so they can make their own PCBs, their own printed circuit boards, and that's as an entry or beginner level workshop, and at the same time, a higher level workshop in FPGA design and FPGA programming. So that's the kind of things that I am enabled to do because I'm in contact with the students and with the university. But I have a strong opinion on what should be considered as formal education. And I think that in the traditional sense, the teacher or the instructor or facilitator of education to the student is not the only way, and in most of the time, it's not the most appropriate way to learn new things. You don't have to have a university degree to make a lot of things that we try to make here. So So that's part of the initiative that I have, to make this as a kind of educational place where you can learn what you learn in the university without having to go through all the requirements mm-hmm. that an university imposes on you.
Yeah, definitely, because you don't need some other degree to be able to learn technical stuff. The most important mm-hmm. thing is to have the desire and the pleasure to play with technology. This is the driving underlying force, in my opinion, that you have fun doing what you're doing and that you are curious about things. You want to know how it works and then you open it up. And when you can transport this feeling, this spirit of curiosity about things, then you maybe get new members very fast. That's what I would hope.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so.
Speaking about growth, you are the first hackerspace who really came to birth, but there are two others, at least in the hackerspaces wiki.
Yeah.
And I haven't found much information about them, also because my Spanish is not as good as I would like it to be. But do you know something about other spaces or other people who are into the hacker scene?
Yeah, exactly. There are people in Mexico City. Since this is the biggest city in Mexico, and you have a lot of interest there, and a lot of people doing similar things. They have, for example, people that are part of the Dorkbot movement, and another friends of us that are in Circuito Electrovisiones. They are making art and electronic things. And I just came back from Mexico City when I was in their space teaching Arduino lessons to eight artists. Yeah. And, I know some people that are very interested in this kind of interaction, like hackerspaces, but I think most of them don't have the information of what a hackerspace is, so they don't think of themselves as a hackerspace, but they have places where they do the same thing that we are doing here.
Spread the word. I mean, it would be great to get in contact, because when you share, especially the knowledge about technical things, it grows.
Yeah.
I mean, you spoke about a bit of the resemblance you have in your country about the word hacker and what people think in a first moment about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we know about the situation in Spain or Italy, that you have many squats in mm-hmm. official hacker spaces, and therefore you have a lot under the radar, a lot is information which is privately exchanged under the hand.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, what do you say? How much is there which is not titled with the word hacker, or which is not as public on the internet as it is in the States or in the, some parts of Europe?
Okay. Well, for example, when we decided for this space to be a hacker space, we started to take into account what the people will think about it. And we saw that there is a lot of artistic groups and media groups, new media groups, doing similar things, and they are not called hackerspaces. And that's a particular point, because, as you said, you have to share the knowledge. You have to, if you are in contact with another group, you can see what their interests and their problems are. And one of the main problems, I think, is that at this time that we are trying to apply, first to have an historical record of what we're doing here, and then to apply for a government grant, government money, so that we can pay the rent and make more projects. You have to sort of educate or inform the people that what is the really meaning of hackers, basically. So I think we still have a lot of things to do before we can reach that point.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I would like to know about your inspiration. Which mediums have you consumed, or which conferences or other hackerspaces have you visited? If you have been to any other, I mean, it's not that easy. I would guess for Mexican people to travel to the States just for a weekend or stuff like that. But where does your motivation come from?
Well, I've been part of the people of the Make magazine, the blog of the Make magazine in Spanish, since they started that project. And at this time, I don't know how they are doing at this time, but most of the time when I think in hacking or making things, I think in all the things that Make magazine has published on their issues all this time. I think I have been a subscriber since number one or number two. I've been pretty interested in that. And some of my students are actually being the editors of the Spanish blog of the Make magazine, and they have gone to the Maker Faire in the States in California. And when I have been traveling through the United States, I have this desire to make a list of all my nerd friends that are there and go visiting each other, each one of them. So when I've been traveling, for example, you told me that you also was traveling in North America. Mm-hmm. For example, I've been in Canada and have the pleasure to meet a lot of people that I admire in what they have done in the hacking sense, because they are very involved with electronics, very involved with music and music devices and circuit bending and guitar pedals, stone boxes and everything. So I think that I haven't been able to be in another hacker space, actually, but I've been in contact with a lot of people that share the same spirit of making things and sharing knowledge and everything. And I think it's being reflected on what I'm doing here.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Do you know about the design patterns of hackerspaces? There was once a document written about the lessons learned from other hackerspaces, and they tried to generalize do's and don'ts for hackerspaces.
I don't know it, and I'm really curious in reading it and learning about it.
Yeah, I'll put it in the link section and send it to you.
Okay,
where do we go on? What is it with conferences in Mexico? Do you have some?
Conferences about hacking?
Yeah, or also maker conferences like the Maker Faire.
We don't have a specific conference on that kind of thing, but since I'm involved in the academic world, I'm always in touch with people making conferences in electronics and sensors, instrumentation, robotics, and everything like that. So I'm pretty much into the middle ground, where you can see engineering as an academic activity and engineering as a part of life, as a way of living.
Tell me maybe a bit more about the networking you do. You mentioned that there are other art spaces and other projects in your city. Do you go for a connection with them? Do you want to have cooperation with them?
Yeah, exactly. That's a large part of what we try to do, to get in contact with other people doing similar things and trying to have activities in common. At this time, for example, I have been told that there's a local group doing homebrew beer, and we would like to do some hackerspace beer, and we would like them to show us how to do that. And maybe if we can arrange a meeting and then a workshop, that will be great for both of us. So that's just one example of the things that we're trying to get in contact and all the activities that we want to do.
I can tell you, you shouldn't go for beer. You should go for Club Mate.
At this moment, I'm drinking mate, but in the traditional South American. Yeah, because I haven't made the connection that this was like an energy drink for all the hacker scene until I saw this article in the new Make magazine about a very popular beverage in Germany called Club Mate or something like that.
Exactly.
And they are exporting it to the States. And since it's it gets really expensive when they get them there, they are trying to make a homebrew mate. And in this city is somewhat easy to find the herb in the places where they sell international stuff like seafood from other countries.
I know what you mean. But I'm drinking Club Mate right now and enjoying it. So and you having the original mate because it's the national drink of Argentina, but you would have the right circumstances to make this home brew mate for the whole American continent. Then you can sell it and you have your rent paid, I will tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Because I don't know if you have seen the traditional way of drinking mate. It's pipe. Yeah.
But please gourd. Explain it to our listeners. Please do.
Okay. Yeah. In Argentina, I've been to Argentina. They carry a bottle with hot water, a thermo bottle, all the place. If they are going to work, if they are driving, if they're in the park, sitting and taking the sun or everything, they have with them a water bottle with hot water. And when you want to drink mate, you take this recipient like a gourd, like, well, there are a lot of shapes and forms and colors, but you take the traditional mate. You fill it up with the herb, like 3/4 of the height of the recipient, and then you start to pour hot water on the herb, and you use a kind of a straw, a metal straw, that you push into the herb and onto the hot water, and it has in the base some kind of mesh or holes, little holes, that when you pour the hot water in the herb, it behaves like an infusion, like when you grab tea and with a bath you put in the hot water, it's the same, and you start to drink it. It has a very special social meaning, because it's a caffeinated drink, like coffee and a lot of drinks, but it has a really big plus. What I mean is that if I'm making my own mate, I'm making it for personal pleasure, and if I take my mate and offer to another person near me, for example, do you want to drink a mate with me? I'm also offering you the opportunity to chat with me, to share and to maybe have a connection, have a complicity, have something in common, And we start to use the mate as the bonding union, the bonding activity between people, and that's part of the social meaning of drinking mate. And there's the side effect of it being highly caffeinated, so that's the useful thing about it. So very different from South America, in Mexico there is no easy way to get yerba mate here. So sometimes when you find a store that carries the herb, you start to go there and get your supplies while they're left. So you have in your kitchen, you have your bag. And if you can, well, if you're really, really fond of drinking mate, you can, for example, drink maybe 1 liter or 1.5 liters during the day. And that will make you very insomniac, I think. And that's how you prepare, how you use, and how you enjoy your mate.
That's really great. And now we are getting very deep into anthropology as well,
exactly.
To follow our title, because this characteristic about consuming mate is perfectly suits also the way mate is used here in Europe, and I guess also in the States. It's this. Mm-hmm. I think it's a social thing. I mean, you can drink your mate also in front of your PC at home alone.
Yeah.
But it is a social thing, you know, and especially when you have when you're consuming something together. In the theory of anthropology, we call something a consume community, which
exactly.
is a very strong thing for most societies. Mm-hmm. It's something powerful where many things, it is somehow a material token of short-term social interaction, even if you don't know each other. I mean, you could also use to reinforce existing connections, but here again, we are sharing, and we are sharing, especially liquids or smoke, are always things that bring people together. That's what I wanted to say. But really, make this homebrew mate and sell it. I mean, maybe it's when it's hard to get the yerba mate herb, then it's not that easy. But if you get any working recipe and then you sell it as the Cholula mate, then I'll tell you, all the Americans will love it.
Yeah, I know people will get very used to it. And I know that there's a very strong market around mate, so that will be a success, I know.
I wanted to ask you about your relationship to other states as well. I mean, you're not a diplomat, but maybe you can tell us something about the relationship from the Mexicans to the Americans. This is somehow problematic, I know from my own experience in Mexico. But is it different in the hacker scene?
No. I think the differences in the hacker scene are much less than in the general population. And why? I'm quite convinced that people have an historical resentment about North America and the States and maybe even Europe, because we were a colonial nation, and then we have this struggle for independence and everything. Then a lot of people don't really believe that made some good to the country or really make a difference in what we were and where we were, what we were doing and where we were going. So, for example, if you talk with anyone in the street, in a bar or somewhere, and ask your opinion about the United States, most of the time they have this kind of ambiguous opinion of the United States being highly capitalistic, war-centered, and having all this strong supremacy all over the other nations. But in the people that form the communities, they most of the time are people with a higher level of education, and I'm not saying that this is a condition or a requirement, but they start to appreciate that your government doesn't fully represent you as a person, as an individual, and that you can have a lot of strong interests and groups and activities with people from all over the world without the division, if it's the people from the neighbor country, and if they are making bad things with other people in the world. So you start to draw a line that allows you to separate what the people has to offer, the individual has to offer, and what you as a nation represent and want to believe. So I don't know if I'm getting clear with this, but I think that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So it is, trying to sum this up, there is a general negative resemblance in Mexico against the States, and maybe against Europe as well, which is understandable from a historical perspective perfectly.
Yeah.
When you look at colonialism and just the historic facts that happened.
Yeah.
It is not that strong in the hacker scene or in the more technical community, maybe also because they have generally higher English skills, and they can also really look at the media, look at the countries from a more inside perspective, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a complicated field, but I would like to stick to this relationship between countries. Maybe we can't make this point with the States clear, but when we look further south, maybe you are the right person to just give us a brief opinion about this. How is it in countries like Brazil? How is it in countries like Guatemala, for example? Do you know something about their hacker scene, the state of the IT industry in these countries?
For example, in South America, they have a lot of activism and hacktivism groups. Rio de Janeiro, in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, in Uruguay, they have to. In Chile, they have a strong presence of these kind of spaces or activities, and I think it's a result of the development of each country. I mean, if my government has reached the point that my well-being is satisfied, then I can start to look for more into a higher level of satisfaction, doing, for example, social or community work, or getting into the activities that a hackerspace or any other kind of spaces can give you. Mm-hmm. So I think the development of your country reflects, is someone represented in the number of hackerspaces and similar spaces that are doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That therefore Mexico is so interesting because you are on the edge in both worlds. You're not really one world, you're not really third world. You're somewhere in between, heading for the north, and with your first space, hopefully this wave goes on. And maybe we do not need this high status of wealth to spread the idea of hacking, and especially hacktivism. We use the new media to raise awareness for new issues in the public opinion. Mm-hmm. It's a very powerful tool, and I would like to see it also in the hands of people from the South.
Yeah.
But let's stick to Mexico again. I mean, One specific issue. Do you know how is the situation with net neutrality in Mexico?
Oh, well, this is it was a hot subject some months ago, because the people in the government are very superficially informed about the state of the things in the internet. So when you're talking about neutrality on the net, you're talking in terms that they don't really understand, because if you go to the Senate to see the people making the laws and everything, they barely can handle their Hotmail account. So that's their level of involvement with the state of the internet. So if you talk to them in terms of we have to charge a higher tax on the internet usage for the next year, they are going to say, yes, go ahead. People will start to say, no, take into account that this is part of the education. This should be like a kind of good coming without taxes. It's doing to the people more good than harm. You shouldn't tax it like if it was a luxury product like a cigarette or everything. So
yeah, it's infrastructure. That's just what I wanted to say. But do we speak about? I mean, net neutrality has two sides to it. The one is that providers or other forces are trying to put new costs into the internet system, especially the huge exchange, the peering of traffic. And then you have the level of surveillance and censorship that you discriminate packets according to their content or to the protocol used. Going down to the level of deep packet inspection, as in the Chinese Great Firewall, for example. And I don't know which side was this discussion about. Was it about the cost thing, or was it about surveillance and censorship?
It was both sides. So most of the discussion was all about the taxes, but a few people were very conscious that this matter of surveillance and going to great depth of packet inspection was really going to be a reality soon if the government was legally allowed to. But at the same time, the common feeling was that the government didn't have the desire or the infrastructure needed to do that. So most of the people just focused on the monetary points of the discussion.
Which could also be a very clever strategy to have the media discussing one issue and doing the politics deeper, something besides or underlying, which is, if you follow conspiracy theories, maybe part of some huge, larger plan or which probably suits in the general American-wide policy about how to treat the networks in general. Let us come to the situation we have right now in Mexico. Maybe you can give our listeners some insights. I would like to talk about the situation in Mexico right now, the surveillance situation, the security situation. Because when I've been to Mexico, one thing you notice on the street is that you have armed guards with very heavy guns on the street, in crowded areas. They're standing there. This is very unusual for me, at least coming from a European country, where guns are something rare, especially in crowded areas and public places. I mean, it was much worse there in Guatemala. This is definitely one side of the subject I want to talk
okay.
about.
Okay, okay, let's talk about it. The situation here is going, I think, reaching higher levels. It's reaching higher levels of police presence and the use of the exhibit of heavy weapons in public, in crowded places. It's part of federal government action in the narco traffic war. You know, the all these problems are being originated in the war against narco traffic. So the government, what?
Narco traffic is the how to say, is the traffic with drugs basically from south to north, coming from Colombia or whichever country and going north over Guatemala, over Mexico to the States, basically.
Yeah. Basically, in Mexico, there's a lot of drug war going on. One of the characteristics of Cholula is that we're in somewhat in a bubble, that we don't get to know a lot of things that are happening, very violent things and things like that. But as you should have experienced in Mexico, it's not a state of war. You are not in a city that it's in war. But it's certainly violent, because you are watching weapons and you're reading the news and you're hearing that people that are coming from another state in Mexico, that they are running away, because they are moving away because the violence in their cities is reaching a very high level that haven't been experienced by Mexicans for a long time. I don't know if historically it was something similar. It was something similar in the past, but at this time, this drug war that most of the people believe it's in part initiated by the government of the United States is the reason that we are seeing all this violence in the country and all this use of the army forces and things like that. That it's quite thrilling, quite terrifying if you're coming from abroad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it definitely does something with society. I mean, you often have discussion in hacker scenes about the sociological effect of surveillance cameras. Mm-hmm. You behave differently when you know that you are watched, and it's a much more crucial effect you have when you have armed men standing at every corner.
Definitely.
But let's. This narco traffic is a very big subject, and I think it's also important to say that Mexico is a very diverse country, and the problems of one state are not the problems of another state. Mm-hmm. When you look at the north of Mexico, close to the Mexican border, I think this problem is very huge. Around the capital, around Mexico City and Oaxaca, I have a feeling that it's a bit less. Maybe coming to the Guatemalan coast and to Chiapas, you have these problems and different problems. And we're not speaking about a homogenic country. It's huge, and it's also a collection of states. And this I have to mention as an anthropologist who has been to this country. Mm-hmm. You certainly have more experience with your country than I do. Do you think Mexico is going more extreme?
Mexico, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you recognize this? Is this more cameras, more guards? Different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, more cameras, more guards, more police, more army, more soldiers, more more military activity, and if you're driving your car in the road, you start to see caravans of 5, 10, 15 military trucks. That's something that in the past it never happened. Well, I'm 34 years and I never seen a state like this. So I think, yeah, it's steadily rising, the violence level, I think.
Okay, then Hackers Save the World. What do you think? Are there opportunities for hacktivism? Are there already projects going on for people pointing out this surveillance infrastructure that's built, or the changes that happen in your society? I mean, usually the internet is a good place to raise awareness for such issues.
Yeah, slowly but steadily, the internet has become a place where people start to get into civil organization to share information and share, for example, strategies or things like that to live in a world where surveillance is the activity that you have to live under. And for example, there are civilian groups that try to organize through the internet for example, manifestations or meetings or protests or things like that. And I think it will eventually reach a level where the people are consuming high quality information, because at this time I have seen the civic society going through different phases. For example, at first all the movements that they saw on the internet being organized, they were trying to be part of that, and they start to see that the organization was not fully being satisfied. So I think eventually it will reach a point where the organization would be more effective than at this time is.
That's probably a quite tough question for your first few months as a hackerspace, but have you made a decision whether you want to be politically active as a space, as a collective, or if you decide to step a bit in the background as a hackerspace? I mean, what would happen if you would be politically active and if you would be a place where people could gather and share ideas and trying to gather a bigger picture about what's happening in the country?
We have discussed this subject several times, and at first we have this kind of punk attitude towards the involvement with the government. Like, for example, if the local government is going to give us some support if we do this or do that, okay, let's go ahead and do nothing and just receive the support. But it was very naive, I think, when we were thinking like that. At this moment, we have decided not to get involved in politics, only to the point where we can get the support that we need, for example, for artistic production or for new media research or things like that, that the government does have a budget that we can take a share of that budget. That's the only way of involvement with the government that we want at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough decision, but you have to you have to decide one way or the other and then live by it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a very important issue, also a reason why I put you on this show, that it's harder for a government to shut a space down which is well connected internationally.
Exactly.
So, please do a lot of documentation. Show us everything you do. Use the wiki or whichever channel to keep us informed about what you're doing. And maybe it's harder for them when the general public is watching, or at least the international hackerspaces movement is watching what's happening with these spaces in the South. And hopefully you won't be the only one south of the States. I would love to see more.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So should we end as pessimistic as we are right now, or are we...
No, I think we can end with a more optimistic view of the things. If we expand upon the idea of document all the activities and things like that. At this time, we're making every Wednesday and every Saturday movie projections. On Wednesday, the movie projections are about musical documentaries. So most of the time, all the activities surrounding the movie projection is try to meet new people and share what you have and show them the space and everything like that. And it has been great. We have received a very good response from peers, from people, from friends. So I think this kind of cultural activity is getting us very near the people that share the same interests that we do. So at this moment, that's one of the activities that we are trying to document, what we're doing, what we're learning, what we're sharing in these movie projections.
That's great. And keep on going for the students and for the Arduino stuff, because I think this is really also exciting many people. Arduino excited me, and I'm not that good at soldering. I thank you very much for this discussion, and I hope to hear much more from your side, and hopefully our listeners enjoyed this show as well. And if they have any questions, there will be a link section to this show in the hackerspaces.org wiki, and we will also put this show online on talkingantropology.com, the usual site for this podcast, which existed a bit more than a year and is now also co-produced here for hackerspaces.org. Be aware, most of the originally produced shows are on German, and it will be a continuous flow of German and English, and hopefully in some future also Spanish episodes there on talkingantropology.com. But this is it for today from my side, and I hope we can hear us again in 1 month. And I thank you, Felix, for this great talk and this great interview. And hope to hear you soon.
Okay, thank you.